Hi, this is Brian, and we are reading The Hill for Wednesday, April 8. The story is The Hill's morning report, Trump Resets the Clock on Iran Talks, What to Know. In today's issue, Trump, Iran agree to two-week ceasefire, NATO's Rutte visit Washington, liberal candidate flips Wisconsin court seat, abducted journalist freed. President Trump has reset the timer on his threats to bomb Iran back to the Stone Ages, after Tehran agreed to reopen the Strait of Hormuz for 2 weeks in exchange for a temporary pause in U.S. and Israeli attacks. With less than 2 hours remaining before his 8 p.m. ET deadline last night, Trump announced a delay, touting progress in negotiations that he said would soon bring hostilities to an end. The reason for doing so is that we have already met and exceeded all military objectives, and are very far along with a definitive agreement concerning long-term peace with Iran and peace in the Middle East, the president said in a post on Truth Social. We received a 10-point proposal from Iran and believe it is a workable basis on which to negotiate. Almost all of the various points of the past contention have been agreed to between the United States and Iran, but a two-week period will allow the agreement to be finalized and consummated, he added. Trump said his agreement followed conversations with Pakistani Prime Minister Shahbaz Sharif and Field Marshal Asim Munir. He said the deal is subject to Iran agreeing to complete immediate and safe opening of the Strait of Hormuz. Iranian Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi, issued a statement on behalf of Iran's Supreme National Security Council, agreeing to the terms. If attacks against Iran are halted, our powerful armed forces will cease their defensive operations, he said. Araghchi said safe passage through the Strait of Hormuz will be possible through coordination with Iran's armed forces and with consideration of technical limitations. While the White House touted the deal as a victory, Middle East experts said Trump seems to have handed a major win to Iran without gaining any long-term commitments in return. The most important sentence in Trump's ceasefire post is that the ensuing negotiations will be based on the Iranian 10-point proposal and not Trump's 15-point, said Trita Parsi, the co-founder of the Quincy Institute on Responsible Statecraft, in a post on social platform X. Iran's 10-point plan reportedly includes the U.S. lifting all sanctions it has placed on the country, allowing Iran to charge $2 million per oil tanker passing through the Strait of Hormuz, guarantees that Iran would not be attacked again, and reconstruction funding. It does not include Iran giving up its remaining weapons-grade nuclear material, a key demand of many Iran hawks. It would also keep the Islamic regime intact. In the best-case scenario, Trump struck a deal to reopen a strait that was open before the pointless war he started, with the IRGC demonstrating its control over the strait and potentially extracting fees plus sanctions relief. Ben Rhodes, a former top Obama administration foreign policy staffer, wrote on next Tuesday night. The news was met with tepid optimism by European leaders, who have been increasingly critical of U.S.-Israeli operations in Iran. Ceasefires are always good news, especially if they lead to a just and lasting peace, but this momentary relief cannot make us forget the chaos, the destruction, and the lives lost, said Spanish Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez, a staunch critic of the war. The government of Spain will not applaud those who set the world on fire just because they show up with a bucket. What's needed now, diplomacy, international legality, and peace. Israel was reportedly sidelined in the talks, and the blowback on Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu was swift. There has never been such a political disaster in all of our history. Israel wasn't even at the table when decisions were made concerning the core of our national security, Israeli opposition leader Yair Lapid wrote online Tuesday evening. The military carried out everything that was asked of it. The public demonstrated amazing resilience, but Netanyahu failed politically, failed strategically, and didn't meet a single one of the goals that he himself set, he added. Tehran and Washington remain far apart in terms on a long-term peace deal. Trump on Monday said Iran's 10-point proposal was a significant step, but not good enough for him to back off from his threats to launch attacks on power plants and bridges. Iran also rejected the U.S.'s 15-point plan as unrealistic. That plan reportedly includes a rollback on Iran's nuclear program and limits on its missiles. Sharif, the Pakistani prime minister, invited the two sides to Islamabad on Friday to begin negotiations on a conclusive agreement to settle all disputes. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth and Chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff General Dan Kane are scheduled to deliver a press briefing this morning at 8 a.m. ET. It comes after a briefing scheduled for Tuesday morning was canceled ahead of Trump's deadline. Three things to know today. Republican Clay Fuller has won a special election to fill the seat vacated by former Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene, Republican of Georgia. His victory will give the GOP one extra seat cushion in the closely divided House once he is sworn in. Trump announced a slate of endorsements in Indiana legislative primaries set for May, declaring his support for candidates challenging Republicans who opposed his push for the state to redraw its congressional lines before the midterms. The suspect in the Gilgo Beach, New York killings is reportedly expected to plead guilty today in court. Multiple outlets reported Rex Huerman has been accused of killing seven women and dumping their bodies on the beach on Long Island. Leading the day, timely visit, NATO's Secretary General Mark Rutte is set to visit the White House today at a critical time for relations between the U.S. and its Western allies. The trip comes as the U.S. has grown increasingly isolated over its war with Iran, with most European allies keeping their distance from the conflict and some denouncing the operations despite pressure from Trump to get involved. Their refusal has added to Trump's years-long frustration with NATO, leading him to escalate his threats last week to withdraw the U.S. from the alliance in one of his strongest rebukes yet of the organization. The comments spurred backlash from European allies, Democrats, and even some Republicans, as critics noted that withdrawing from NATO requires congressional approval, a prospect that seems highly unlikely. As The Hill's Ryan Mancini reports, Rutte's visit could shake up the state of play on two fronts, the paused U.S. offensive against Iran and the U.S.'s future in NATO. Rutte has enjoyed a strong working relationship with Trump over the past year, becoming known as NATO's Trump Whisperer on account of his ability to defuse conflicts between the U.S. and Europe. He was credited with helping to cool tensions over Trump's months-long demands that the U.S. be allowed to acquire Greenland. He does seem to have a way of speaking to Trump that keeps the United States and the Trump administration engaged in NATO in a constructive way, Matthew Kronig, Vice President and Senior Director of the Atlantic Council's Scowcroft Center for Strategy and Security, told the Associated Press. Still, the task before Rutte may be among the most challenging he's faced as relations are even more strained. DHS dissent. The conservative House Freedom Caucus came out against a two-step proposal backed by the president to reopen the Department of Homeland Security, or DHS, adding an obstacle to getting the plan across the finish line. The House is set to take up a Senate-passed bill to fund all of DHS except for U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, and Border Patrol as soon as next week, when the chamber comes back from recess. After passing that, the plan would be to move additional funds for ICE and Border Patrol through the reconciliation process, which can pass without Democratic votes. But the Freedom Caucus said Tuesday that those immigration enforcement agencies can't be left hanging on the hopes that reconciliation, a difficult process, is successful. We must provide robust funding for ICE and CBP, and it should be done with all of DHS in Reconciliation 2.0. We can fund DHS for the rest of the president's term to ensure Democrats can never again take our nation's security hostage, the caucus said in a post on X. The caucus members' opposition will add to what was already going to be a difficult task for House Speaker Mike Johnson, Republican of Louisiana. House Republicans, during a private call last week, raged over the plan and Johnson's flipping after initially being opposed to the idea. Trump said he wants the reconciliation bill to reach his desk by June 1, but the Freedom Caucus said it could tightly control this process. Majority expanded. Liberals expanded their majority on the Wisconsin Supreme Court on Tuesday as Democratic-backed candidate Chris Taylor easily cruised to victory over her Republican-backed opponent. Taylor defeated Maria Lazar, a fellow appellate court judge, in the race for retiring conservative justice Rebecca Bradley's seat on the court. Taylor leads by more than 20 points as of the latest vote count. The pickup for the court's left wing will expand their current 4-3 majority to 5-2, ensuring its control stays in place at least through the end of the decade. The race was formerly nonpartisan, but Democrats and Republicans rallied behind opposing candidates. Wisconsin Supreme Court races have been a common occurrence in recent years, gaining national attention, and liberals have now won multiple contests in a row. And another race is already on the horizon as conservative justice Annette Ziegler doesn't plan to seek re-election to another term next year. Epstein testimonies, a string of notable individuals with ties to Jeffrey Epstein or the investigation into him, are set to testify in the coming months as a House committee continues its probe. A person familiar with the matter told The Hill's Miranda Nazzaro on Tuesday that Microsoft co-founder Bill Gates will appear before the House Oversight and Government Reform Committee in June, one of the most high-profile figures to testify. Gates received attention earlier this year after his name appeared in released Epstein files showing he communicated with the disgraced financier years after Epstein's 2008 sex crimes conviction. The scheduling of Gates' testimony is the latest of a few that have been put on the calendar in the last couple days. Multiple outlets reported Monday that Commerce Secretary Howard Lutnick agreed to testify in May, following revelations that he was in touch with Epstein years after he originally indicated he had cut off contact. Tova Noel, a corrections officer who was on duty when Epstein died by suicide in federal custody in 2019, is scheduled to testify in May, and Epstein's former personal assistant, Leslie Groff, is also set to testify in June. The interviews will likely keep the spotlight on the Epstein controversy, even as the Department of Justice, or DOJ, has said it has released the documents required under the law. First impression, Acting Attorney General Todd Blanch gave his first press conference Tuesday since taking over leadership of the DOJ, defending the president's vision for the department. "Nobody has any idea why the Attorney General is no longer the Attorney General, and I'm the acting Attorney General except for President Trump," he said about why former Attorney General Pam Bondi was fired. Blanch said he wasn't sure how Trump views DOJ's leadership, including whether he would be nominated as Attorney General permanently, return to his former role as a Deputy Attorney General, or do something else. "I love working for President Trump. It's the greatest honor of a lifetime. And if President Trump chooses to keep me as acting, that's an honor. If he chooses to nominate me, that's an honor," he said. "If he chooses to nominate somebody else and ask me to go do something else, I will say, thank you very much, sir. I love you, sir. So I don't have any goals or aspirations beyond that," Blanch added. In the where and when, the president will participate in executive time at 8 a.m., he will meet with Agriculture Secretary Brooke Rollins at 11:30 a.m. He will participate in an interview at 2 p.m. He will meet with Rutte at 3:30 p.m. and participate in a Freedom 250 reception at 5 p.m. The House and Senate are out today. Dress rehearsal. A handful of potential Democratic contenders for the 2028 presidential nomination will appear this week at the Reverend Al Sharpton's National Action Network Convention, making an early appeal to the party's key black voter constituency. The most prominent figure at the convention will be former Vice President Kamala Harris, who is scheduled to speak Friday, the first female black vice president and 2028 presidential nominee. Harris has said she wouldn't rule out another White House bid, but she's far from the only rumored contender set to take the stage. Other featured names include former Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg, Pennsylvania Governor Josh Shapiro, Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker, and Senator Ruben Gallego of Arizona. The Hill's Amy Parnes reports the gathering offers a rare and early opportunity for the attendees to start building credibility with the demographic. Black voters are a core, if not the core, group of constituents in the Democratic coalition, and this is the first time these candidates are going to be sized up, Democratic strategist Joel Payne said. It's a chance to reset narratives and set what your public profile might be. Swift release. U.S. journalist Shelley Kittleson has been released a week after she was kidnapped in Baghdad by an Iranian-backed Iraqi militia group. Secretary of State Marco Rubio confirmed Kittleson's release. The organization Kataib Hezbollah said it would free Kittleson but required that she leave the country immediately as a condition for her release. Two militia officials told the Associated Press that Kittleson was let go in exchange for the release of several militia members detained by the Iraqi government. The group said the agreement will not be repeated, pointing to the U.S.-Israeli operations against Iran. Alex Plitzis, who is Kittleson's emergency contact and a national security analyst for CNN, said in a post on X that he and others had been in touch with U.S. officials throughout the day about her release. He expressed appreciation to various U.S. government agencies, the Iraqi government, supporters, and advocates. Kittleson has covered the Middle East for more than a decade, often taking gutsy informal assignments in dangerous areas. She most recently worked for the news outlet Al Monitor. She was abducted late Tuesday. Officials captured one suspect soon after the kidnapping, but failed to track Kittleson down. They believe Kataib Hezbollah was responsible for the abduction, but didn't have confirmation until the militia announced her release. Joyce Karam, the editor-in-chief of Al Monitor, called Kittleson's apparent release a glimmer of good news. And finally, NASA has released the first images captured by the Artemis II crew during their flyby of the moon, showing a vantage point from its far side. The crew aboard the Orion spacecraft set a new record for distance traveled from the Earth as they flew around the moon, breaking a record previously held by Apollo 13. Among the images are an Earth set, a picture showing the Earth appearing to set below the moon. Thousands of pictures are expected to ultimately be taken and made available from the journey. The crew is set to return to Earth on Friday. The story: Trump suspends attacks on Iran for 2 weeks amid negotiations. President Trump said Tuesday that he would suspend an escalation of attacks on Iran for 2 weeks as long as Iran agrees to open the Strait of Hormuz. In a Truth Social post less than 2 hours before his 8 p.m. EDT deadline for Iran to make a deal to open the strait, the president said conversations with Pakistani Prime Minister Shahbaz Sharif and Field Marshal Asim Munir led to the double-sided ceasefire. The reason for doing so is that we have already met and exceeded all military objectives and are very far along with a definitive agreement concerning long-term peace with Iran and peace in the Middle East, he wrote. Trump said a 10-point proposal was also received from Iran that is a workable basis on which to negotiate. Almost all of the various points of the past contention have been agreed to between the United States and Iran, but a 2-week period will allow the agreement to be finalized and consummated, he wrote, on behalf of the United States of America as president and also representing the countries of the Middle East. It is an honor to have this long-term problem close to resolution. Iranian Foreign Minister Saeed Abbas Araghchi shared a statement on behalf of the Supreme National Security Council of the Islamic Republic of Iran that expressed gratitude and appreciation to the Pakistani officials who helped negotiate the ceasefire. If attacks against Iran are halted, our powerful armed forces will cease their defensive operations, the statement said. For a period of 2 weeks, safe passage through the Strait of Hormuz will be possible via coordination with Iran's armed forces and with due consideration of technical limitations. Iranian Foreign Minister Sayed Abbas Argachi shared a statement on behalf of the Supreme National Security Council of the Islamic Republic of Iran that expressed gratitude and appreciation to Pakistani officials who helped negotiate the ceasefire. If attacks against Iran are halted, our powerful armed forces will cease their defensive operations, the statement said. For a period of 2 weeks, safe passage through the Strait of Hormuz will be possible via coordination with Iran's armed forces and with due consideration of technical limitations. A White House official said Israel has also agreed to the 2 week ceasefire. This comes after Sharif earlier Tuesday asked Trump to extend the deadline because diplomatic efforts were ongoing, and the White House said Trump was reviewing it. Sharif said in a statement on the social platform X on Tuesday that Lebanon and elsewhere is also included in the 2 week ceasefire. He invited leaders from the U.S. and Iran to Islamabad to continue negotiations for a conclusive agreement to settle all disputes. Both parties have displayed remarkable wisdom and understanding and have remained constructively engaged in furthering the cause for peace and stability. We earnestly hope that the Islamabad talks succeed in achieving sustainable peace and wish to share more good news in coming days, Sharif wrote. The White House said nothing has been decided yet about attending in-person talks. There are discussions about in-person talks, but nothing is final until announced by the President or the White House, White House Press Secretary Karoline Leavitt said. Trump threatened Tuesday morning that a whole civilization will die tonight, never to be brought back again unless something revolutionary wonderful occurs to get a deal agreed upon by the U.S. and Iran. The president said Monday that the reopening of the strait is a very big priority after another ceasefire proposal was submitted to the U.S. but was shot down. The closure of the strait has destabilized oil supplies and sent prices skyrocketing since the war began over 5 weeks ago. Iran has only let a few ships through for a fee, and Trump has said as a gift to the U.S. to show they were serious about negotiations. A Bahrain-led resolution that aimed to reopen the strait failed at the United Nations on Tuesday. A dozen countries, Bahrain, Democratic Republic of Congo, Denmark, France, Greece, Latvia, Liberia, Panama, Somalia, United Kingdom, and the U.S., voted in favor of the resolution, but vetoes by Russia and China tanked it. Colombia and Pakistan abstained. Trump told reporters at a news conference Monday that if Iran did not come to the U.S. with a deal, then the country's infrastructure, bridges, and power plants would be decimated by midnight. Still, he maintained that the country was negotiating in what he hoped was good faith. The threat of the attacks on Iran's infrastructure raised questions of war crimes and led to a long list of Democratic lawmakers calling for the 25th Amendment to be invoked and Trump to be removed from office. Some Republicans, too, broke with Trump after he threatened to destroy Iran. Texas GOP Representative Nathaniel Moran condemned Trump's threat to destroy Iranian civilization. "I do not support the destruction of a whole civilization. This is not who we are, and it is not consistent with the principles that have long guided America," Moran said Tuesday on X. Senator Lisa Murkowski, Republican of Alaska, wrote on X that Trump's threat cannot be excused away as an attempt to gain leverage in negotiations with Iran. "This type of rhetoric is an affront to the ideals our nation has sought to uphold and promote around the world for nearly 250 years, she said. The story, Trump's grave threats toward Iran stoke war crime debate. President Trump's dire warnings to strike Iranian civilian targets if Tehran does not meet his calls to open the Strait of Hormuz is opening a fierce debate over whether service members will be asked to carry out what amount to war crimes under the Geneva Convention. His increasingly grave language, a stark departure from the public rhetoric of past U.S. presidents, has alarmed legal experts who say it's a dangerous escalation that creates a permissive environment for civilian harm. The military right now is trying to translate the commander's intent into lawful military objectives, but what can be lawful is awful, said Rachel Van Landingham, a retired Air Force lieutenant colonel and former judge advocate. The law of war allows for a great deal of civilian harm, a great deal of destruction in particular, because the United States takes a more stretched view. It's controversial regarding what's lawful military objective in the first place. The immediate threat to Iranians seems to have dissipated for the moment. Trump on Tuesday evening said the U.S. and Iran have agreed to a 2-week ceasefire, less than 2 hours before his 8 p.m. deadline for a deal to Tehran to open the Strait of Hormuz. But for weeks prior, Trump had steadily ramped up his bellicose rhetoric over the vital shipping lane that Tehran has blocked since the start of the war in late February. The president had promised to hit Iranian power plants and bridges if the regime did not agree to his demands, warning the attacks would send the country back to the Stone Ages. Iran has previously rejected U.S. terms for a 45-day ceasefire in exchange for reopening the waterway, among the other demands, calling the plan unrealistic and pressing for a permanent end to the hostilities. That appeared to enrage Trump, who on Easter Sunday ordered Tehran to open the effing strait, you crazy bastards, or you'll be living in hell. Just watch. Then on Tuesday morning, he posted on Truth Social that a whole civilization will die tonight, never to be brought back again if Iran does not meet the deadline to reopen the critical shipping channel. Deliberate attacks on civilian infrastructure, including power plants, desalination stations, bridges, roads, and other infrastructure, are considered violations of the laws of war under the Geneva Conventions, which asserts that strikes shall be limited strictly to military objectives. Attacks on civilians and civilian infrastructure also would violate such agreements as the United Nations Charter, the Hague Conventions, and the Nuremberg Principles. The United Nations, in a pointed post to the social platform X on Tuesday, issued a reminder on the standards of international humanitarian law. Even wars have rules, the UN wrote. Asked Monday how military attacks on civilian infrastructure would not be considered war crimes, Trump replied, "They killed protesters, they're animals, and we have to stop them, and we can't let them have a nuclear weapon, very simple." Van Landingham said that while the law of war allows for a great deal of destruction and violence, it tries to minimize it by engaging in checks and balances. It's ensuring that you're finding an actual military objective, not just going after every single bridge because it's there, she said. You have to find that link, that connection to where the effective contribution to the military operations. Trump's rhetoric is dangerous, she said, because it seems to convey that civilian harm is acceptable in attempting to gain concrete military advantage. I fear that there's a stretching effect because of this, she told The Hill. I believe our folks are very well trained. They're not going to simply say, yes, sir, we're going to bomb every power plant and bridge. But I fear that in doctrine that the United States has used before, but used in a more discreet manner, can be used in this kind of circumstance to find more targets to satisfy a presidential commander-in-chief's intent, and that means more human or civilian suffering. Brian Finucane, a former State Department lawyer who is now a senior advisor on the International Crisis Group, called Trump's comments unprecedented and said wide-scale destruction of infrastructure without distinguishing between civilian and military targets would constitute a war crime under both international and U.S. law. While civilian sites can be considered legal targets if they are used by military, such as a bridge being used to transport military equipment or vehicles, that determination is made on a case-by-case basis, he told The Hill. The mere speculation that at some point in the future a missile or drone or components thereof might be driven over a bridge is not enough to make it a military objective, Finucane said. In principle, targeting individual bridges could constitute a military objective, but the present statements that attack all of them means they're attacking civilian objects as well, which would be a war crime. Finucane also worried that Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth's steady dismantling of roles and offices meant to uphold military rules of engagement in favor of lethality is eroding the steps usually taken in deciding military targets. In one of his first orders upon entering the Pentagon last year, Hegseth fired three top uniformed lawyers known as Judge Advocate Generals, or JAG. Obviously, the Secretary of Defense wanted to cow the military lawyers. He said he has this long history of just disintegrating the law of war, specifically denigrating JAGs. They don't want the long way of whatever they want to do. Democrats have cried foul over Trump's threats, with a wave of them on Tuesday calling for the 25th Amendment proceedings, the process of replacing a U.S. president who is deemed to be unable to perform their responsibilities. House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries, Democrat of New York, called on Congress to immediately end the war in Iran before Trump plunges us into World War III. It's time for every single Republican to put patriotic duty over party and stop the madness, Jeffries wrote on the social platform X. Senator Mark Kelly, Democrat of Arizona, a Navy veteran, on Monday evening said it's hard to see how threats to target power plants and other non-military targets, if carried out, would not violate the laws of armed conflict. America leads best with strength, discipline, and professionalism, Kelly wrote on X. Illegal orders make civilians suffer, would be a black mark on our military and our country. Republicans, meanwhile, are split between pushing back on Trump's language or insisting it's all bluster to get Iran to come to the table. I do not support the destruction of a whole civilization. That is not who we are, and it is not consistent with the principles that have long guided America, Representative Nate Moran, Republican of Texas, wrote on X Tuesday. How we protect the lives of the innocent is just as important as how we engage the enemy. Senator Ron Johnson, Republican of Wisconsin, on Monday cautioned the president against escalating the conflict by striking civilian infrastructure. I do not want to see us start blowing up civilian infrastructure, Johnson said on journalist John Solomon's podcast. I do not want to see that. We are not at war with the Iranian people. We are trying to liberate them. Senator Lisa Murkowski, Republican of Alaska, said Trump's threats to a whole civilization cannot be excused away as an attempt to gain leverage in negotiations. This type of rhetoric is an affront to the ideals of our nation, has sought to uphold and promote around the world for nearly 250 years. She posted to X, this oppressive terror-spreading regime of the Islamic Republic must be distinguished from the people and the civilization of Iran. Everyone involved, especially the president and Iran's leaders, must de-escalate their unprecedented saber-rattling before it is too late. But Senator Lindsey Graham, Republican of South Carolina, a staunch supporter of Trump and the war, on Monday insisted that this time tomorrow night, we're going to have one or two scenarios: capitulation of Iran's desire to rain terror on the world through diplomacy, or we're going to have a massive military attack, destroying the regime's capability to ever wage war again. Representative Mike Lawler of New York, meanwhile, on Tuesday morning, insisted Trump is not talking about obliterating innocent people, rather about taking decisive action against Iran's energy and civilian infrastructure. The story: Trump, Iran deal, total and complete victory for U.S. President Trump, in a new interview, praised the two-week ceasefire deal reached with Iran as a total and complete victory for the U.S. Trump told Agence France-Presse, or AFP, that there is no question that it is a U.S. victory. He also said in the brief interview that he believes China intervened to persuade Iran to negotiate. We have a 15-point transaction, of which most of those things have been agreed on, Trump said. We'll see what happens. We'll see if it gets there. The president also told a news outlet that Iran's enriched uranium will be perfectly taken care of, or I wouldn't have settled. He did not elaborate. Stopping Iran's nuclear program and preventing Tehran from developing a nuclear weapon was a focus of the Trump administration during the conflict. Iran has long stated that its nuclear program was designed for peaceful purposes. White House Press Secretary Karoline Leavitt late Tuesday echoed the president's sentiment about the Iran ceasefire agreement. The success of our military created maximum leverage, allowing President Trump and the team to engage in tough negotiations that have now created an opening for a diplomatic solution and long-term peace, she wrote on the social platform X. Additionally, President Trump got the Strait of Hormuz reopened. Never underestimate President Trump's ability to successfully advance America's interest and broker peace. The deal reached between both countries and Israel came after Trump threatened Iran's whole civilization if a deal was not reached and Tehran did not reopen the Strait of Hormuz before an 8 p.m. EDT deadline Tuesday. The deal was reached only a couple hours before the deadline Tuesday. AFP reported that Trump would not say if he would revive his threat, which prompted overwhelming backlash from Democrats in Congress who accused the president of announcing a war crime and called for the invocation of the 25th Amendment. "You're going to have to see," he told the outlet, "about whether or not he would revive his threat. It is unclear when the ceasefire will start." The plan to reopen the Strait of Hormuz, which has remained closed since the start of the conflict on February 28, includes the caveat that Iran and Oman will have vessels passing through pay fees that will go toward Iran's reconstruction, a regional officer told the Associated Press. Trump wrote on Truth Social that the U.S. will be involved with alleviating the traffic buildup in the Strait, will be loading up with supplies of all kinds and just hanging around in order to make sure that everything goes well, he said. Israel and Gulf partners noted that missile attacks were ongoing in the hours after the deal was reached. The United Arab Emirates intercepted missiles and drones, while Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, and Bahrain issued alerts for potential threats. An Iranian missile attack in southern Israel prompted early warnings in central and northern Israel early Wednesday morning, the Times of Israel reported. The story: House Democrat says he has filed articles of impeachment against Trump. Representative John Larson, Democrat of Connecticut, on Tuesday said he filed impeachment articles against President Trump for the war in Iran, citing his recent social media posts promising to erase a whole civilization if the Strait of Hormuz was not reopened immediately. Trump paused the strikes for 2 weeks Tuesday evening after Pakistan intervened and asked for an extended deadline. "Donald Trump has blown past every requirement to be removed from office, and it's getting worse. His illegal war in Iran is not only driving up prices for American families, it has cost American lives," Larson, who's in his 14th term, said in a statement. "He's becoming more unstable by the day. His profane and sacrilegious Easter Sunday and subsequent threats, including a whole civilization will die and open the Strait or you'll be living in hell, not only foreshadow war crimes, but put our security at risk," he added. A total of 70 Democrats, including former Speaker Nancy Pelosi, Democrat of California, Senator Chris Murphy, Democrat of Connecticut, and Representative Yasmin Ansari, Democrat of Arizona, said Trump's cabinet should invoke the 25th Amendment, which would spark an involuntary transfer of power from the president to the vice president due to an inability to serve. Members of Trump's cabinet have backed these strikes and maintained that the White House war objective is to prevent Iran from obtaining nuclear weapons. Meanwhile, longtime Trump supporters, including Alex Jones, Megyn Kelly, and Tucker Carlson, said the president's Sunday post threatening to bomb Iran's civilian infrastructure went too far. Others brushed aside concerns about the threat of strikes. "We're talking about taking decisive action against Iran's energy and civilian infrastructure. That's what the president is talking about," Representative Mike Lawler, Republican of New York, told CNN News Central. "He's not talking about obliterating innocent people." Still, Larson said the president's remarks signal an inability to serve. "People across my district know he is unfit to lead and are calling for impeachment, while Republicans in the majority have so far failed to uphold their constitutional responsibility to initiate impeachment proceedings. That does not absolve others of their duty. Members of the cabinet and those closest to the president can act immediately," Larson said. "They have an obligation to put patriotism over politics and invoke the 25th Amendment. Donald Trump is unable or unwilling to faithfully execute the responsibilities of the office, and he is putting our nation's security and economy in jeopardy," he added. The story: White House budget would cut thousands of TSA jobs. What to know? President Trump's 2027 budget proposal would cut thousands of Transportation Security Administration or TSA jobs in a push toward privatizing the agency founded in 2001 that is housed under the Department of Homeland Security. Conservatives have long sought to outsource airport security, arguing that shifting screening to contractors would cut costs and improve operational efficiency. Critics, including labor groups and some Democrats, say private companies would prioritize profit over security, risking passengers' safety and leading to significant job losses. The debate has taken on renewed urgency in recent weeks after Congress failed to pass funding for DHS, leaving TSA officers working without pay for weeks and straining airport operations nationwide. More than 500 officers resigned during the lapse, and thousands more skipped shifts each day, contributing to long security lines and flight delays. The administration is now proposing to expand the use of private screening through its latest budget request, touting the existing contractor-run program at nearly two dozen small airports around the country as a more flexible and cost-effective model that would shift screening away from a federal workforce. What's in the budget? The White House requested a TSA budget of $11.7 billion for fiscal year 2027, including 53,199 positions and 50,398 full-time equivalents, or FTEs, according to a DHS congressional justification report on the TSA budget request. That represents a reduction of 8,385 positions and 9,439 FTEs from the fiscal year 2026 annualized continuing resolution. Among the thousands of jobs proposed to be cut are 2,462 transportation security officer, or TSO, positions and 4,351 TSO FTEs. Under a section of the budget called Workforce Reshaping, another 1,347 positions and 511 FTEs would be cut. At the same time, the administration is proposing a significant expansion of privatized screening at specialized and smaller airports. Funding for the Screening Partnership Program, or SPP, which allows private contractors to conduct screenings, would increase by $477.3 million, a move offset by a $529.3 million reduction in TSO personnel costs and benefits. Despite these reductions, TSA will maintain all priority mission-critical positions to ensure operational effectiveness and mission continuity, the congressional justification document reads. Push for privatization. The proposal builds on renewed interest in privatizing airport security that intensified during the recent government shutdown, when TSA staffing shortages led to hours-long security lines and widespread flight delays. The disruptions underscored the system's reliance on congressional action to keep federal workers paid. 20 airports across the country participate in SPP, which allows private contractors to conduct screenings under TSA oversight. Those airports largely avoided the kinds of disruptions seen elsewhere during the DHS shutdown, in part because their workers are paid through pre-funded federal contracts. While smaller airports generally experience fewer challenges than the country's largest air hubs, those 20 airports were uniquely insulated from the fallout, a contrast proponents point to in arguing the model is less exposed during funding lapses. The idea has gained traction in conservative policy circles in recent years. The Heritage Foundation's Project 2025 blueprint called for privatizing TSA, estimating the government could save up to 20% by outsourcing screening operations. The Trump administration has echoed that argument, pointing to existing SPP airports as evidence the model can reduce costs while maintaining security standards. The fiscal year 2027 budget proposal says the shift would yield cost savings compared to federal screening and begin reform of a troubled federal agency. For more than 20 years, TSA's Screening Partnership Program has allowed participating airports to contract screening services to qualified private companies. These companies operate under federal oversight, complying with all TSA security standards while delivering an exceptional experience for travelers, a spokesperson for the White House Office of Management and Budget, or OMB, said in a statement to The Hill. Expanding this program has been proposed in several of President Trump's budgets, and it has worked well in the airports where it is already operational, the statement continued. Union pushback to the effort. The American Federation of Government Employees, or AFGE, the union representing most TSA workers, has forcefully pushed back on the effort to privatize airport security, arguing the shift would make travelers less safe. I would not personally want to fly if I knew the whole entire system was privatized because it's not just safe for the American people. Johnny Jones, AFGE, TSA Council 100 Secretary Treasurer, and AFGE Local 1040 President, said at a press conference earlier this month. Jones characterized the push to privatize security as an effort to put profit before people and security. Because that's all privatization is, bottom line is profit. P is for profit, not for people, he continued. It's very important that people understand what privatization is. It has nothing to do with your security or safety. It has everything to do with somebody making a profit. In response to the White House budget proposal, AFGE officials said they would fight against the effort. This is something we have expected. It is part of Project 2025. We take this threat very seriously and will be in the fight to ensure it doesn't happen, a spokesperson for AFGE told The Hill. The story, Democrats build on overperformance streak in Wisconsin, Georgia elections. Democrats' high hopes of a flip were dashed in Georgia's special House race on Tuesday, but an overperformance in the red district, plus a landslide win for liberals in a Supreme Court race in Wisconsin, underscored the party's enduring momentum as the high-stakes midterm cycle ramps up. Backed by President Trump, Republican Clay Fuller won the Peach State runoff to replace former Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene, Republican of Georgia, the longtime Trump ally who quit the House in January amid a feud with the president. But Democrats notched a notable overperformance in the red district, further fueling their winning streak ahead of the midterms. Over in the Badger State, Democratic-backed judicial candidate Chris Taylor easily won an open seat on the state Supreme Court, overperforming GOP-backed candidate Maria Lazar by about 20 percentage points, with most of the vote reported by Decision Desk HQ, or DDHQ, to give the liberal faction on the court a 5-2 edge. The victory is only the beginning of the fight ahead to win a Democratic trifecta in November and deliver real lasting change for the working people of Wisconsin, the Democratic Party of Wisconsin said in a statement. In Georgia, the Republican win in the 14th congressional district came as no surprise, given its red leanings. Fuller, a local district attorney and the president's pick for the Northwest Georgia House seat, emerged victorious with about 55% support in Tuesday's runoff after coming in second place behind Democrat Sean Harris in a crowded March special election. The results tonight are clear. Northwest Georgia stands with MAGA and demands a fighter on Capitol Hill. Defending the America First agenda, Fuller wrote in a social post after his victory. Harris, a cattle farmer and retired general, lost his challenge against Green by close to 30 points in 2024, and the district went for Trump by about 37 points that same year, according to the down ballot. But Harris, who outraised Fuller by $5 million, pulled off a strong overperformance in Tuesday's race, adding to Democrats' off-year and special election win streak and buoying party hopes of a strong midterm season. This wasn't the result we wanted, but the message is clear. People here are ready for leadership that puts them first, Harris said in a Tuesday social media post. In Chautauqua County, for example, which backed Trump by more than 60 percentage points in 2024, Fuller was up 40 points in the county's Tuesday results. According to Vote Hub data, across the district, Fuller was expected to finish with a swing of nearly 20 points from Trump's 2024 margin of 37 points per DDHQ. Democrats saw the special election as another test of the party's enthusiasm as it has flipped a handful of GOP-held state legislative seats in recent months. The party also flipped two seats on the Georgia Public Service Commission late last year, another sign of the base's enthusiasm and broader frustration with Republicans over the state of the economy. The party had a good night in the Badger State, too, with Taylor winning the open seat on Wisconsin's state Supreme Court to expand court's liberal slant. Taylor and Lazar were vying to replace retiring conservative Justice Rebecca Bradley on the high court, and the liberal candidate was expected to win the seat. DDHQ called the race for liberal candidate just 26 minutes after the polls closed. But Tuesday's results are partially notable, given a downturn in early voting compared to previous state Supreme Court elections and the lack of attention to the contest received nationally. In 2025, data from the Wisconsin Elections Commission found that about 363,000 people voted early in person. That's a sharp decline from the under 150,000 Wisconsinites who did the same this year. Regardless, Taylor led Lazar by about 60% to 40% per DDHQ on Tuesday night. Some political observers have suggested that Taylor could handily win between 16 and 20 points, an overperformance from last year's closely watched election when liberal Justice Susan Crawford beat conservative Brad Schimmel by about 10 points. Still, this year's contest was a sleepier affair than the 2025 race, in large part because partisan control of the court's majority was not on the line. Last year's race drew attention and massive spending from Trump, as well as Elon Musk, in what was viewed as the first political test of the president's second term, as well as a gauge of the tech billionaire's influence. Trump notably declined to weigh in on Tuesday's judicial race, despite flipping the state in the 2024 presidential race. It comes, however, as the president's approval rating has fallen underwater among Wisconsinites. A Marquette Law School poll released last month showed the president's approval rating at 42% in the state, compared to a 56% disapproval rating. But despite the blow in Wisconsin, the GOP win in Georgia offers some breathing room to Trump and House Republicans, given the narrow majority on Capitol Hill. Once Fuller's sworn in Congress, Republicans will have a 218 to 214 advantage in the lower chamber, meaning they can't afford two defections on party-line legislation, assuming all members are present and voting, a critical cushion as the fight for control of Congress rages on. Fuller will serve out the rest of Green's term, which ends in January 2027. Both he and Harris will be on the ballot again in the Peach State's primary elections next month as they run for their respective parties' nominations for a full term in the seat. Democrats, meanwhile, will aim to build on their special election wins and overperformances as they seek to net three seats and take control of the House this fall. The story, Carville, Trump deteriorating at a really rapid rate. Democratic strategist James Carville on Monday said President Trump is deteriorating at a rapid rate as he weighs options regarding Iran and works on messaging to the American people. Trump, who announced Tuesday evening a two-week pause in striking Iran amid a developing ceasefire, addressed the nation last week and again on Monday to outline the military objectives in Iran. Following the president's address, Carville said, "You could just look at the guy as just an average person and say this man is deteriorating at a really rapid rate," during an appearance on MS Now's The Beat. The comments came before Trump changed course on Tuesday's deadline to bomb Iran if the Strait of Hormuz was not reopened. "I don't know. I mean, but it's evident. I mean, Alex Jones sees it. You see. You can see it all over the right. Cut. Got Megyn Kelly and Tucker fighting with Mark Levin. I can't even keep track of all of them. They hate each other when they hate us," he added. Conservative commentator and conspiracy theorist Alex Jones, former Fox News host Megyn Kelly, and former Fox News host Tucker Carlson have argued that Trump was pushed into launching strikes on Iran while urging him to scale back in the war, condemning his threat to strike civilian infrastructure as an illegal order. But with the two-week pause announced, the ultimate plan remains unclear. "America is sinking in global rankings. Likeability, it's just not what we voted for. We never see rhetoric out of presidents like this when we go to war, even if you're for the war. This is really bad PR, folks," Jones said on the podcast last week. On Tuesday, Jones went further and slammed the president's latest threat to bomb a whole civilization in Iran if demands were not met. That is the definition of genocide, Jones, typically a Trump supporter, said in a video posted on the social platform X. Not a war, not a defensive war, but a literal bombardment. Like Martians, you know, attack us and we don't have a defense. Conservative media personality Mark Levin has vigorously defended Trump's decision to strike Iran and argued he was not influenced by Israel or any other external force to start the war. He slammed former National Counterterrorism Center Director Joe Kent for resigning in support of claims that the president was influenced by Israel and labeled Representative Ro Khanna, Democrat of California, as a Jew hater for opposing funding for Israel's Iron Dome in the face of the war. Levin has also criticized coverage of Carlson's comments on the war. The media continue to promote this lunatic Carlson because they can't pretend they're reporting news when they're trashing POTUS, he wrote in a Tuesday post on X. The story, Amazon cuts back postal service deliveries in new agreement. Amazon has reached a tentative deal with the U.S. Postal Service, allowing the mail agency to maintain about 80% of deliveries for the e-commerce giant. The agreement for a 20% cut in postal service deliveries comes after months of negotiations with Amazon, which previously threatened a two-thirds or larger reduction, Reuters reported last month. The deal will come as a relief for the U.S. Postal Service, which is struggling financially. Postmaster General David Steiner warned last month that the mail agency will run out of cash in less than a year amid the decline in traditional mail and regulations. We're pleased to have reached a new agreement with the USPS, or U.S. Postal Service, that furthers our long-standing partnership and will let us continue supporting our customers and communities together, Terrence Clark, an Amazon spokesperson, wrote in a statement to The Hill Tuesday. The Postal Service did not immediately respond to a request for comment. Amazon is the Postal Service's largest customer, according to people with knowledge of the matter, with 1.7 billion of the company's packages delivered annually. This is about 15% of the Postal Service's total year package deliveries, equaling about $6 billion in annual revenue, the Wall Street Journal reported. The Amazon contract was set to expire in September, and the tentative agreement must now be approved by the Postal Regulatory Commission. Amid negotiations in the past year, the Postal Service launched a new bidding solicitation for its last-mile delivery network. Steiner said the bidding would help the Postal Service determine the true market value of the service, the Journal reported, but the bids did not meet the agency's expectations and prompted the Postal Service to engage more directly in negotiations with Amazon. The story, Democratic presidential candidate set to court black voters at Sharpton's Nan Convention. A parade of potential 2028 presidential contenders is set to take the stage this week at the Reverend Al Sharpton's National Action Network, or NAN, convention for an early audition aimed at courting black voters, one of the Democratic Party's most powerful constituencies. In a party where black voters have repeatedly shaped the outcome of the Democratic primary, the gathering will offer a rare and early opportunity for the candidates, including former Vice President Kamala Harris, former Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg, and Pennsylvania Governor Josh Shapiro, to begin building credibility with the voting bloc. Black voters are a core, if not the core, group of constituents in the Democratic coalition, and this is the first time these candidates are going to be sized up, Democratic strategist Joel Payne said. It's a chance to reset narratives and set what your public profile might be. The event, Payne added, will start to give you a sense of what this field is going to look like.